At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Procter & Gamble and Coca-Cola are two American companies feeling the effects of the crisis in Egypt. They both shut down or curtailed operations there, but the potential effects for this country spread far beyond that. Our exports are stuck in Egypt's ports, and there are growing fears about the flow of oil from that region. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Event Marketing, working to help small businesses and nonprofits make their events easier with event registration and marketing tools. ConstantContact.com. And by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl on this last day of January 2011. Thanks for making us a part of your Monday. The Egyptian government vowed today to open a dialogue with all political forces, and it says a key demand voiced by opponents of President Hosni Mubarak will be on the table, constitutional and legislative reforms. But before that can begin, there are more immediate issues to resolve, growing shortages of everything from food to fuel, which could make the troubles there worse before they get better. New York Times reporter Nicholas Kulish is watching developments in Alexandria, Egypt. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
We've been hearing that growing prices for food staples have been adding to the overall sense of discontent in that region for some time now. Now you're reporting that the political crisis could quickly become a serious humanitarian problem. Tell us what kind of shortages you're seeing there.
Well, you know, you're seeing shortages in all the basic food staples. People are buying what they can off the shelves, but, you know, distribution has been affected, and there's a bit of panic setting in as well.
And the big thing I understand is bread. Egyptians are the world's top consumers of bread, and Egypt is the world's biggest wheat importer.
That's true. The government is doing everything it can to keep the subsidized bread coming out of strategic supplies. There are reports that isn't working entirely, but you know there are a lot of other serious issues. Today and tomorrow are payday here, but the banks have been closed since Friday. Basically, a lot of Egyptians who live day to day, week to week, just aren't getting the money they need to survive.
And I understand that some ATMs have been running out of money.
I think you could say most ATMs have completely run out of money. I was actually told today about a gentleman who was specially sent by his bank to fill up an ATM, and he was there for 2 hours, and the money it was empty again when he was leaving. Just the people came and took it as fast as it showed up. All over the city, ATMs are just plain out.
Is there any more of a sign of stability at the ports, or is it still chaos?
Well, the port itself is very stable. There's a tank sitting in front of it, and basically nothing goes in and through the front gates, and nothing comes out through the front gates. Meanwhile, the containers just stack up there because the companies would rather pay the fees for storage than take the risk of losing it on the roads.
And is the unrest, the fear of violence, causing any problem with deliveries, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. I spoke to the head of a distribution company today that has 350 trucks, and one of his trucks was burned because it was outside a police station, and he said, my trucks aren't going anywhere. He said, the safety of my employees comes first, and this is a guy whose trucks deliver water and diapers.
Which leads me to the question about gasoline supplies. We usually don't think of gasoline shortages in the Middle East, but are the shipments of gasoline coming through to the stations?
Not the stations that we've talked to. A lot of them just have barricades up and don't let any customers in. And the few, I'm thinking, well, we drove around Alexandria today and saw one that had gas, and there was a four-lane line, each lane 20 cars long, I guess. I mean, so really that tells you something about the situation.
And does this increase the risk of a backlash if people can't put bread on the table, if they can't get gasoline to get around?
Well, a backlash, I assume you mean against the protest movement?
Well, either direction, I guess.
I mean, what we're seeing talking to regular people is that they still want the government to step down and that they're sort of blaming it on them. But it is sort of an irony that economic discontent was driving a lot of this, and now things are just getting worse.
Nicholas Kulish is watching developments in Alexandria, Egypt for the New York Times. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Wall Street managed to get by the Egyptian crisis with a winning day. Details when we do the numbers. Fears over those Egyptian protests rippled through global oil markets today. Crude prices hit $100 a barrel on concerns the Suez Canal could end up being shut down. There's a deeper worry that the unrest could spread to other, much bigger oil-producing countries in the Middle East. But as we mentioned, stock markets around the world pretty much shrugged off those concerns. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
2 million barrels of oil pass through Egypt every day, most of it by tanker through the Suez Canal. Disrupting or stopping that flow would certainly hit the oil markets, says Jason Kenny, energy analyst with the ING Bank.
If you were to see a total shutdown of Egypt, including the Red Sea and the Suez Canal, then it would be similar effect to, say, a hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico.
But the oil cartel OPEC could make up that shortfall, pumping as much as 5 million barrels more a day. What's really worrying the oil market is the fear of instability, and that unrest having spread from Tunisia to Egypt could now take hold elsewhere in the Arab world, perhaps even in Saudi Arabia itself. Then, say analysts, crude prices could easily hit $150 a barrel. Neil McKinnon is with VTB Capital.
If we were to see a sharp spike up in the oil price from here, that would have a very damaging effect on the prospects for global economic recovery during the course of this year.
Which makes the generally muted stock market reaction in Europe and the US seem a little odd. But Mike Lenhoff of stockbrokers Brewin Dolphin says equity investors are focusing on growth in the US and China.
Both China and the United States are really spearheading the expansion that it will take place this year. And I think that's what equity markets have their sights on.
But he concedes that even stock market investors are not totally oblivious to the Egyptian turmoil. They're watching the protests just a little nervously out of the corner of their eyes. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Chrysler reported earnings today. It lost a lot of money, largely because of expensive interest on loans from the U.S. and Canadian governments. Detroit's longtime number three was able to deliver a somewhat surprising operating profit last year, though, $763 million. Still, as CEO Sergio Marchionne put it, the company's job is not done. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
There are a lot of people who didn't think Chrysler would live to see 2011. But it has, after declaring bankruptcy, getting a government bailout, and selling a quarter interest to the Italian carmaker Fiat. If Sergio Marchionne, the CEO, is right, Chrysler will even turn a profit this year. Bruce Belzowski is at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. He's not as optimistic as Chrysler's CEO, but he does give the company a passing grade.
They get a B-minus right now. That's not C's or D's. And I think for any car company in this stage, that's a decent grade.
The reborn Chrysler made it through its first big challenge. It introduced new and improved versions of several vehicles, the Jeep Cherokee, for example, and drivers like them. But there are plenty of challenges still to come.
The longer term is that the Fiat-based vehicles still need to make it into the U.S.
The company's just starting to roll out the first of those models, the iconic Fiat 500. There'll be more next year. Michael Robinette is an analyst with IHS Automotive, a consulting company. He says Chrysler still has a long way to go.
The end game for Fiat in the future is to really gain a lot more flexibility in where they can take Chrysler in terms of modifying the operations, bringing in new vehicles, and not really have any equity stake from the government.
Sergio Marchionne, the CEO, says the company's working on it. He says he'd like to pay back more than $5 billion in U.S. government loans this year, which will help pave the way for Chrysler to get listed on the stock market again. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Get this. The cost of a ticket to this past weekend's World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, was a mere $19,000. One ticket, all for a chance to network with CEOs, heads of state, famous academics, and it is hoped the ability to see the global financial system in a new light. Marketplace's Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio keeps an eye out for ways that the financial system can better serve more people. Hello, David.
Hey, Bob.
So some of the smartest folks on the planet have been talking about the global economy for the past few days. And what has come out of their deliberations that gets us closer to making the economy work better for more people?
All right. Among the ideas that may float forth from Davos, one of them is enabling the globalization of talent. Let's say you have an entrepreneurial woman in India who has a lot to give and is eventually going to have a big business that employs a lot of people. Remove the barriers to her moving to where the capital is, the venture capital, the employees, i.e., come to the United States. That's one of the ideas. Another one is called the Robin Hood tax. You heard of that?
No. Tell me about it.
Well, what does Robin Hood do? It takes from the well-heeled and gives to the poor. We heard this from President of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, also head of the G8. The idea, tax international financial transactions. Imagine how many of those there are. Imagine the money that could be raised. Yeah, a lot, I would say. Financial transactions tax. So the idea is to take the proceeds and give it to developing nations to help them develop further.
And the reaction to that?
Not going to be so warm on Wall Street, but the global anti-poverty group Oxfam thinks it's a great idea.
Now, one of the sessions at Davos involved a search for what was titled a new economic narrative for the 21st century. They figure that out?
Well, 20th century narrative, capitalism versus communism, capitalism wins. 21st century started with the collapse of the market system. So what's next? I got to talk to Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winner and Columbia University econ professor, and he thought the story would be something like this realization.
Clearly, our financial system took enormous returns, but didn't actually lead to faster economic growth or more stable economic growth for the American economy or for the global economy.
So according to Professor Stiglitz, the new narrative is about what is the return of all this financial activity to society. He says it has to be about well-being, like is your population better off, and it has to be about jobs. Long-term unemployment here and in developing countries came up a lot at Davos.
Of course, David, Davos got upstaged this year to some extent by the unrest in Egypt. How much did that detract from the conference?
It actually fit into a pair of the major themes that came up at a lot of the conferences, near as I could see. One of them is this issue of the destabilizing effects of long-term unemployment, especially youth unemployment, which is behind a lot of the tensions that we're seeing playing out in Egypt and in Tunisia. The other issue is rising commodity prices, particularly food prices. We're not talking about it much here in the U.S. yet, but I saw the UN data. Food prices are up 25% in the last year around the world. And one of the responses at Davos is rein in commodity speculators, presumably driving up some of these prices. But the chairman of Nestle, the big food company, he sees it differently. He says, you want to bring down food prices? Maybe we should stop turning food into biofuel. Now, of course, he's talking about corn being turned into ethanol, an idea that may not go over that well in Iowa.
It's a lot of talk, which is what Davos is known for. Where's the action plan?
Well, Davos is about being a cauldron of ideas, action plan, maybe from the G20, G8, International Monetary Fund, or a reformed United Nations.
David Brancaccio, thanks.
My pleasure.
There's more about Davos and that Joseph Stiglitz interview on the Economy 4.0 blog. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up, there's one building in L.A. that's the funnel for West Coast internet traffic.
That's the LAX equivalent of the internet. You know, if LAX shut down, it's not as if all air travel would stop, but it would be a huge mess.
Understanding internet kill switches. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average pumped up 68 points, 0.5%, to finish at 11,891. Today, by the way, caps the best January performance for the Dow since 1997. The NASDAQ climbed 13 points, also 0.5%, to close at 2,700. The S&P 500 rose 9 points, 0.75%, to finish at 1,286. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley all gained about 1%. ExxonMobil gushed up more than 2% after announcing better-than-expected profits. BP rose 2.75%. Chevron pumped up 1.75%. ConocoPhillips gained 1.25%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.38%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing partner to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/grow. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for December. The federal government begins a two-day National Bedbug Summit. This is the second summit dedicated to little bloodsuckers. And the Senate Judiciary Committee looks at the role of bankruptcy in the foreclosure process. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Charlie Sheen's latest issues could affect production of his hit comedy, Two and a Half Men. If you haven't heard, Sheen has checked himself into a rehab clinic. Again. And he's expected to be there for the next 3 months. It could spell trouble for the show. Or maybe not. It is, after all, TV's most watched sitcom, and it's worth hundreds of millions of dollars to CBS and Warner Brothers. Here's Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Two and a Half Men, a show about an OCD divorcee and his teenage son living with his par-drinking, womanizing brother, attracts 14.5 million viewers a week. And they don't seem fazed by Sheen's real behavior, including trashing a room at the Plaza and partying with prostitutes in Las Vegas. Bill Carroll is with Katz Television Group.
When the incident happened in New York at the hotel, the Monday after on the network, the ratings actually went up.
And as far as the network is concerned, it will do and spend whatever it takes to keep the show on the air with Sheen, says TV critic Aaron Barnhart.
There's just absolutely no reason to even think about a plan B as long as this thing is printing money the way it is.
A lot of companies have a lot of money tied up in Two and a Half Men. CBS reportedly took in more than $150 million in ad revenue last season, and reruns are scheduled to air for the next 10 years.
Two and a Half Men right now is sort of in the seat that Seinfeld was in for several years, and before that, Cheers, and before that, The Cosby Show.
Not that it's anything like The Cosby Show. Two and a Half Men is pretty raunchy, which is one reason audiences come to the show, says Bill Carroll.
The expectations of the audience are that he's going to be a little bit of a bad boy. And when he turns out to be, the expectations are not crushed.
Hi, I'm Charlie.
Linda.
Hi, Linda. I got to tell you, I have never met a judge before. You know, voluntarily.
I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
The Egyptian crisis reminds us just how closely interconnected our global economy is. We also saw proof of that in the way the economic downturn hit pretty much everyone, including undocumented workers. As informal jobs in the U.S. and Europe have dried up, many Latin American workers have found themselves with little choice but to return to their home countries. Annie Murphy has the story from Bolivia.
The La Paz airport is a handful of gates and a single restaurant. The cramped arrivals area is full of tourists, business travelers, and increasingly retornados, returned migrant workers. Many have been in the U.S. or Europe for years, working to send money back to this remote country in the Andes. Unemployment here is about 10%, and most jobs don't pay enough to meet basic monthly expenses, like food, electricity, and water. The government estimates that up to a fifth of Bolivians live outside the country, mainly in the U.S., Argentina, and Spain. But with the global economic crisis, many are returning home. Arturo Calle is one of them. He just returned from 5 years in Spain, working as a gardener, farm laborer, and street vendor.
Spain has deflated like a balloon. For migrants in general, employment has disappeared. A huge number of Latinos have been laid off. This is why people are going back to their home countries.
Sociologist Bruno Rojas studies labor and migration. Rojas says each day at least 60 Bolivians return, just from Spain alone. And according to Rojas, they're coming back to a place where their options aren't much better than when they left, Arturo Calle.
It really makes you think to go backwards. Nothing has changed here in Bolivia. You get here and you think, what happened? How did I get here?
There's also some shame associated with returning from abroad. Calle is now trying to start a business importing motorcycles from China. He says the venture is going well and that he's busy, but his tiny office is barren and dead quiet. Just him, a desk, and a stack of empty folders. He's already thinking about going abroad again.
Immigration is part of human nature. You go to the other side of the world, get to know it, and try to better your situation. Returning immigrants are going to come home, and then they're going to take another path, find another destination.
Sociologist Bruno Rojas says one popular destination seems to be losing its appeal, the U.S. With the economic crisis in the U.S., he says, Latin American immigrants have been among the first to lose their jobs. They also face increasingly strict American immigration laws. And all that, says Rojas, means the U.S. is losing its reputation as the land of opportunity. Experts say migrant workers, particularly those from South America, are now turning to Brazil, which has a booming economy and friendlier immigration policies. In La Paz, Bolivia, I'm Annie Murphy for Marketplace.
As we reported up top, the political tension in Egypt continues to escalate. Beyond a rush on cash and food staples, most of the country's internet access has been cut off, although the government has apparently kept vital links open to the country's stock market. There's word that most people there are turning instead to good old-fashioned dial-up access. But it got us wondering, how easy is it to just switch off the net? Andrew Blum is a tech writer for Wired magazine, and he's currently writing a book on the infrastructure of the web. Welcome.
Thank you.
So how did it happen that a good percentage of the internet connections in Egypt got shut down?
Well, as near as anybody can tell, and this is mostly from the intelligence of a company called Renesas, right after midnight on Friday morning, Egypt time, it looks as if somebody started making phone calls to the five major internet service providers in Egypt. And one after another, their routes, their sort of signposts to their users disappeared from the global internet.
So could this kind of shutdown happen here in the U.S.?
It seems almost impossible to conceive, partly just based on sheer size. I mean, right, we don't have five ISPs. We have hundreds, if not thousands. And then, of course, even some of the largest, like Verizon or Comcast, would themselves have sort of dozens, if not hundreds, if not thousands of different network head-ins. And you'd essentially have to dismantle each of those individually.
So I've heard that the internet is sort of self-healing, but are there certain choke points that it would be vulnerable?
Yeah, well, the flip side of that is for a smaller, mid-sized network, there's what's called the network head end. There's the place that the rest of its internet flows from. And for a small network, it would be quite straightforward to literally pull the plug, pull the yellow fiber optic plug that connects their edge router, as it's called, a sort of washing machine sized Cisco router usually, to the rest of the internet. And if that happens, then all of their customers would then be offline.
Let's explore that a little bit more. You visited a data center, a choke point, if you will, in southeastern Wisconsin. Describe for us what that looks like and how service providers connect to consumers, actually.
That's a building in downtown Milwaukee. That's just a regular office building that's been colonized by different internet companies. The one that I visited serves about 15,000 customers in southeastern Wisconsin, and they have one of these routers with notably two yellow fiber optic cables leaving it. One goes to Time Warner in another suite inside the building. Another goes to Cogent, an internet backbone company, and also inside the building. And from there, they serve their 15,000 customers.
Now, I understand that when we're speaking globally, that a lot of our communications to Asia, for example, route through a single building here in Los Angeles. Can that sort of choke point really cause problems?
That's LAX. I mean, that's the LAX equivalent of the internet. You know, if LAX shut down, it's not as if all air travel would stop, but it would be a huge mess. The same is certainly true for One Wilshire, this very well-known building in downtown Los Angeles. That said, though, you know, we're looking tomorrow at another storm here in New York, and the airports are going to be shut down again, and life goes on and business goes on.
So let me pin you down. Is the internet here to stay? Are we always going to have the internet, or is it possible that one day somebody could decide to shut it down here in the U.S.?
Well, the basic idea of the internet is that it's a network of networks, and each of those networks is independently operated. And because of that, you have a lot of versatility and a lot of security because it's sort of inherently public. It has to sort of follow certain protocols if it wants to communicate with other networks. It's easy to imagine the internet fragmenting in certain ways, but the basic concept of a network of networks disappearing seems hard to fathom.
Andrew Blum is a tech writer at Wired Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at Putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, the Obama administration has yet another legal obstacle to its health care overhaul. Today, a Republican-appointed Florida judge declared the legislation unconstitutional. U.S. District Judge Roger Vinson says the bill forces people to buy health insurance by 2014 or face penalties, and that violates people's rights. Vinson wrote in his ruling that if the government can force people to have health care coverage, it could just as easily force people to buy and eat broccoli regularly. The Justice Department plans to appeal, and it'll almost certainly end up in the Supreme Court. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow pumped up 68 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq climbed 13 points, also 0.5%. And the S&P 500 rose 9 points, 0.75%. Our producers include Abishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this program.
If someone has to pick up a sick kid early, one of us can cover for the other, and we kind of understand those things.
This group of moms has to do with the cars of the future. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.